Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, June 9th, 2016. Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today.
We are going to fight hard to win the primary in Washington, D.C. And then we take our fight for social, economic, racial, and environmental justice to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We continue the fight in the last primary. I am pretty good in arithmetic, and I know that the fight in front of us is a very, very steep fight. But we will continue to fight for every vote and every delegate we can get.
Well, that was Bernie Sanders late on Tuesday night, striking a confident and defiant tone after his loss to Hillary Clinton in California and New Jersey. Now, those wins made it irrefutable. Hillary Clinton has a majority of the pledged delegates she needs for the nomination. Later on this hour, we're going to talk about the media and whether pronouncing Hillary Clinton the presumptive nominee before everyone had voted in Democratic primaries was the fair and ethical call. But even as defiant as Sanders sounded there, even some of his strong supporters are ready to concede and get to what Sanders himself has said is the most important thing, keeping Donald Trump out of the White House. Now, Sanders meets with President Obama today at the White House in private in the Oval Office, where they need to chat about healing, about unity, and yes, about what Bernie Sanders gets out of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party for his strong but insufficient showing in those primaries. Phil Johnston is a former chair of the Massachusetts Democratic Party, and he's feeling a sense of deja vu today. He was in a similar position 8 years ago when then-Senator Barack Obama defeated Hillary Clinton and became the presidential presumptive nominee for the Democrats. He joins me from our partner station, WGBH in Boston. Phil, welcome.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be with you.
Well, things are a little different this time. 8 years ago, the insurgent defeated the establishment candidate. This time around, the establishment candidate beat back the insurgent and all his young and excited voters.
Yes, and it is deja vu. I was with Obama. I think I was the first chair in the country to endorse Obama. And, you know, I got to know him a little because of Deval Patrick's gubernatorial campaign here. And Obama was a big, you know, supporter of Deval's. And I was blown away by his presence and his charisma and his policy agenda as well. And I think this time Bernie ignited the passions of a lot of progressive Democrats. And, I mean, at the end of the day, he got about 45% of the Democratic vote. And I think he should be very proud of that. And I think everybody who supported him should feel proud of it.
So how do you envision this conversation between Bernie Sanders and the president going today in the Oval Office? I'm sure the president's going to say what you just said. We're all very proud of you. 45%. Wow, Bernie. And then what? Let's get practical and transactional.
I think people should remember, despite the headline The Times this morning, as it calls him a renegade. I mean, he's not a renegade. He's been in politics for 25 years, been in the Congress for 25 years, and he's an experienced practitioner of the political process. He's a realist. He understands that that we're not going to win the nomination, but he also understands that he has, in fact, received 45% or so of the Democratic vote, and he has millions of supporters around the country, and he doesn't want to let them down, and so he's going to go to Philadelphia and fight around platform issues, and we all know what those issues are about economic inequity and affordable public higher education and campaign finance reform, et cetera, et cetera. And I might add that I think there's going to be a fight on rules around superdelegates and be a strong effort to eliminate that practice. It hasn't been a good process for a long time, and I think that he'll be fighting that battle. I'm on the rules committee myself, and so I'll be playing a role in that also that I'm looking forward to.
This conversation today may be in the Oval Office, ongoing conversations with Hillary Clinton. What do you think he asks for? He wants her to say, okay, I'll push for the $15 minimum wage, not 12, or does it look like something more important but maybe smaller bore? You know, I'll seek your advice, Bernie, on my decisions on who to nominate for Treasury Secretary and SEC Chairman to police Wall Street when I'm president. Does it look like that? What are the policies, do you think?
Well, you take the $15 an hour issue, for instance. I think that most Democrats support support Bernie on that issue. So I think Hillary would be well advised to support it. If she and her people decide not to support it, then there'll be a fight on the floor, and I think we'll win it. So while a lot of people said that Bernie Sanders was some kind of wild-eyed radical during the campaign, the fact is that these are pretty much an extension of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and John F. Kennedy's New Frontier. There's nothing radical about these issues, and they're very mainstream. And I think that most Democrats at that convention would be hard-pressed to vote against them.
So this is about fighting it out on the convention floor if they disagree, not about a promise from maybe perhaps future President Hillary Clinton about what she'll back, because the Democratic Party can back a $15 minimum wage at the convention. A President Clinton, if there ever is one, can just say, yeah, I'm still in favor of 12.
Well, she's going to have to make a decision about that, and I'm just making the point that I think that the Democratic Party most members of the Democratic Party support Bernie Sanders' positions on a lot of these issues that he's talked about, and that's the reason that he ignited such support around the country. The Clintons have a long, deep history with Democrats who have been in the process for a long time, and I think that explains to a large extent why she won. Although, look, she's a tough-minded, strong candidate, and I give her huge credit for what she's accomplished here, and I think she's going to be a very strong candidate going into the fall election, and I, for one, intend to work hard for her. We cannot have Donald Trump anywhere near the White House, as Hillary says. And I think we're going to see Bernie out there too. We're going to see Barack Obama out there. I think Elizabeth Warren will join the campaign very soon also. And I think we're going to have a united party.
Phil Johnston, before I let you go, we got to talk about the Massachusetts question here. You're former chair of the Massachusetts Democratic Party, and there's a big Massachusetts issue. A lot of people are starting buzz, including Harry Reid, that they want Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren on the ticket with Hillary Clinton. What is that going to mean for your state? And by the way, you guys have a Republican governor. That could be putting a Senate seat at risk.
I think that if Elizabeth were to be selected and she would agree to go on the ticket, and by the way, I think it would be a great ticket personally, I think that we'd be okay in terms of holding that seat.
Not worried about a repeat of the Scott Brown experience in Massachusetts.
Well, one always worries about having been burned once. We don't want to be burned twice.
Conversations, concessions, negotiations between Senator Bernie Sanders, the president today at the White House, Hillary Clinton, and Democrats all over the country, including in Massachusetts, where maybe they'll be asked to sacrifice a senator for the Democratic ticket. Phil Johnston, former chair of the Massachusetts Democratic Party. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd.
Remember in 2008 when a young, new candidate electrified young voters? Well, this time around, there was a not-so-young candidate, still new to the nation, though, who did the same thing.
Young people understand that they are the future of America, and they intend to help shape that future.
Record numbers of young voters turned out in primaries and caucuses this year. But with about half of millennials identifying as independents, according to the Pew Research Center, how does the next generation plan to govern America? There's a group aiming to bridge the divide in the political world through millennial leadership and entrepreneurial approaches to policy. Stephen Olakara is president and co-founder of the Millennial Action Project, and he's here with me in the studio. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What is Bernie Sanders' success said about millennials in the political process to you?
Well, it shows that millennials are willing to challenge existing institutions. In addition to that, millennials are looking for authenticity, which polls consistently showed that Bernie Sanders was the most authentic candidate and ranked the highest on the honest and trustworthy scale. So I think millennials gravitated towards that.
The machinery of public policy, legislatures, government are designed to keep this kind of thing at bay. They're not innovative. They tend to maintain the status quo. That might have some advantages, but the kind of thing that you're talking about, the next Uber, the next iPhone, the next sharing economy, walk into Congress and there's a whole lot of nope going on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why in 2013, in the wake of the government shutdown, we launched the nation's first ever bipartisan youth caucus, the first time in our country that the youngest members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, came together in a generational unification to focus on the issues that we're going to inherit in the long term. And all the dysfunction and partisanship we're seeing right now, it's caused us to govern from short-term crisis to short-term crisis, and we're not addressing the long-term challenges like climate change and our national debt.
I'm still having a little bit of a hard time, as great as this all sounds, and it is, because all kinds of political organization are great to me. I'm having a little bit of a hard time grasping how this is different from the last time I heard about Young Voters for Climate Change or the Young Democrats or the College Republicans. This kind of thing has always existed, and I need to understand why this is different. Is it because of the power of social media? Is it because of the power of the sharing economy and how that can change the way politics is funded? What is it?
It's those two things plus the power of the circumstance. This year, the parties have been disrupted in many ways. The levels of Americans as a whole identifying as independents, rejecting the two parties as they are, is at an all-time high. And at this moment, in many ways, our organization planned ahead for this moment. There is a huge opportunity. When we see a breakdown in our political system, there's an opportunity for a breakthrough in a new generation of leaders.
And if you can find the right message, I mean, let's get practical for a second. It seems to me that a lot of this power gets harnessed at some point in the future, which may never happen, when you can have a unique identifier and just vote on your iPhone.
Right. And there are lots of interesting political startups and voting apps that are coming online right now. There's a huge opportunity for that. And the fact that we're not seeing it yet shows the amount of challenge that we have in the entrenchment among the incumbents in our political industry. But what I would suggest to people who don't believe that we need change and reinvention in our democracy is for people to look at our founding fathers. Most of the founding fathers in 1776 were under the age of 40. I mean, the founding fathers were basically millennials. James Madison was 29 years old when he was elected to the Continental Congress. He authored the Constitution when he was 36 years old. Thomas Jefferson was 33 when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. So these were young upstarts who created our country. And it's very much in the spirit of our founding fathers that this generation, millennials, have the opportunity to reinvent our democracy.
Stephen Olcara, president and co-founder of the Millennial Action Project. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton earned the presumptive part of that title the day before Tuesday's primaries, on a day when no voters went to the polls and no votes were cast. Instead, the Associated Press's call was based on interviews with superdelegates who pledged to support Hillary Clinton but don't actually vote until the conventions in July, and who, Bernie Sanders reminds us, could be persuaded to change their minds between now and then. Stephen Olmarker from the AP led the vote count. Here is his response on Fox News.
When you know something, you know, this is news. You know, we've been counting delegates in primaries and caucuses. We've been calling superdelegates and reporting on what they tell us. And when we got to 2383, that's news. The fact that a candidate for the Democratic nomination has the support of enough delegates to win the nomination at the convention, that's news, and reporting the news is what we do.
Joining me now to discuss the AP's decision is Jerry Hester. He's director of reporting and writing at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism here in New York. Jerry, welcome.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, what do you make of the timing and the process that the AP used here?
Well, look, this is something that clearly, for a lot of reasons, the Clinton camp didn't like. A lot of voters may have not liked. And the Sanders camp certainly hated. But the AP, in the end, did its job. It reported its news, and it did it in a proactive way. You know, in terms of the timing, it wasn't as much as before the six primaries this past Tuesday, but after the primary in Puerto Rico. That's when the numbers really told the story.
But here's the big problem, though, is that the AP surveys superdelegates. They have the count of pledged delegates, and they say, based on our conversations with who the superdelegates are going to support, she has enough people for the nomination. The question is, who are they to say that? Bernie Sanders is correct. They could potentially, as unlikely as it is, go to every superdelegate and convince them to change their minds. It may be a long shot, but if it's possible under the rules, who's the AP to say that she's got the nomination?
I mean, that's absolutely true. But AP is reporting a moment in time. And the key word, and the one they keep using, is presumptive. You know, you can imagine if AP would have come out and that their reporting would have shown that delegates were thinking about turning to Bernie, that would have been an incredible story as well. And that would have been one that they should have broken the moment they were confident of being able to say that.
So we don't report results like this or exit polls like this until polls close. There have been lessons learned on election nights that you don't do that reporting until everybody has gotten a chance to vote. They even withhold results because of time zones, right? So that California voters or Oregon voters don't get turned off and stay home. It seems like this may have had a similar effect, though.
You know, I would I'd say there's a difference here when you're dealing with, you know, calling an election based on early returns and or exit polls. You're making an extrapolation. And, you know, certainly as we learned in 2000, there's a time zone issue, as you point out. But I think this is a different kind of exercise. This was reporting. This was the AP going out and talking to 700 odd people. It's, I think, a lot different than kind of a mathematical exercise where you're extrapolating from numbers. And again, they're reporting what it is in time now. Could that change? Possibly. Could this potentially have an effect on whether that changes or not? Absolutely. But it's not the AP's job to protect us democracy from itself. It's AP's job to report the facts as they are.
Did the AP do a good enough job of making all of those stipulations that you and I have been making? That yes, superdelegates are free to change their minds. Yes, they could. This is a moment in time, but right now we're saying this. It could change if Bernie Sanders hits a home run.
Yeah, I think in the way that they framed it in terms of calling her the presumptive nominee, in terms of any kind of speculation in their own main story, there wasn't much. But their story certainly has spurred that conversation and more.
And of course, once that story gets onto cable news in particular and conversations like this, it's not covered in the nuanced way. The Chyron says AP colon Hillary Clinton presumptive nominee. That matters.
Absolutely. The headlines matter. And as you can see, this story from the AP made headlines. It was a banner headline across the top of the New York Times, both on the physical paper and on their homepage and in the mobile feed. And in all of those, in big letters, you had AP says.
What about the accusation from the Sanders campaign that if not a conspiracy, this was an establishment nudge towards Hillary Clinton from the AP, from the corporate media that was designed to put his candidacy to bed finally?
I can't say what goes on in terms of the decision making at the AP and what spurs them. But from their public accounts, from the way that the story has been presented, and seemingly from the solid reporting behind it, they're telling the news.
And we should also be clear about Bernie Sanders in this conversation, too. This is an experienced politician who knows the rules, not only in the Democratic Party, but in the media and how the game is played. And he understands if a news organization is going to make a call, that he can play it a certain way to make it seem like they're all against him. That plays to his campaign narrative.
Well, yeah. In terms of his narrative, it's not him losing New Jersey necessarily. It's not him losing California. It's turning on this idea of the superdelegates. And remember, the superdelegates are something that he has not necessarily been in favor before, but now they've become his last and perhaps only hope.
Competing incentives in a fast-moving campaign, the AP's timing, and their judgment in reporting that Hillary Rodham Clinton was the presumptive nominee before everyone went to the polls in New Jersey and California and everywhere else on Tuesday. Jerry Hester, Director of Reporting and Writing at the CUNY Graduate School for Journalism. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
Tonight is Game 5 of the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Pittsburgh Penguins have a commanding lead over the San Jose Sharks. Now, the Sharks are playing in their first Stanley Cup finals in the team's history, but they're down 3-1. The Penguins have been stellar in this series so far. Sidney Crosby, much to the dismay of hockey fans anywhere except in Pittsburgh, is on the verge of his second Stanley Cup victory. Now, hockey is a traditional game. In Canada, the most popular commentators play a dual role. They analyze the game and also sometimes keep it safe from outsiders. Anyway, if you've watched any hockey, you'll know that this is how announcers typically celebrate a goal.
And the stick knocked out of the hand hands of Burns, and then another one thrown toward the front that was blocked off by Jones. Still, they battle in front.
So that was the call from the great Mike Emmerich when Nick Bonino scored the go-ahead goal in Game 1 for the Pittsburgh Penguins. And here it is again, this time in Punjabi. Now, the man behind that energetic call and many more like it.
My name is Harner Ayan Singh, and I'm the host and play-by-play commentator for Hockey Night in Canada in Punjabi.
Now, Singh's great-grandfather was one of the first Sikhs to emigrate to Canada, and he says he's always dreamed of becoming a hockey announcer.
You know, I was obsessed with the sport, and, growing up in a small town in southern Alberta where there wasn't any other visible minorities, hockey was the icebreaker for me amongst my classmates.
Shot laya, Jones roka, rebound to Kargene goal. Wah, bhai, wah, ki hai mere goal? Goal hai mere goal. Goal hai mere goal. Ian Cole, the goal.
Now, Hockey Night in Canada is a very traditional show, kind of like the one I mentioned at the top. Sometimes it protects the game from outsiders. Hockey Night in Canada Punjabi, however, is in its ninth year, and Singh says that the broadcast has helped spread the sport in the country's large Punjabi community. After English and French, Punjabi is the most common language spoken in Canada.
People find that they have more camaraderie amongst their colleagues at work because they're able to participate in those conversations about last night's game. Or we also have amongst the immigrant families, you know, the grandkids born here have a natural inclination to liking hockey. And because of the broadcast now in Punjabi, they're able to understand the game. And three generations are watching hockey together. It's a tradition now in their family household.
So how does it feel?
It's amazing. I mean, it proves that, you know, it's not just fun and entertaining. It's connecting and bridging the gap between immigrants and their new country. And, you know, it's a great way to show how multiculturalism can work really well through the universal power of sport.
Well, this year, Singh and his team are enjoying some fame in the States as well, thanks to that viral Bonino, Bonino, Bonino call that you heard from Game 1. Singh gives credit to his passionate co-hosts and their production team and their relatively new social media staff who got that out all over Facebook and Twitter. In fact, Singh has only just learned that his show already has a lot of fans in California, the sizable Punjabi community in California's Bay Area. Well, unfortunately, those San Jose fans haven't been hearing a lot of Singh's calls for goals in their favor in this series.
You know, as a broadcaster and been following the sport for so long, I was happy for Thornton and Marlow and the gang to finally make it there, but it's almost as if they already won their Stanley Cup. It was beating Los Angeles was such a big deal, and then making the final for the first time in their 25-year franchise history, it's almost like that was their cup.
Goal, Nick Cartata, goal, except for Penguins.
Singh says he hopes that one day he could see a Punjabi player in the NHL. Minorities of any kind are a rarity in hockey, but Singh says there's already an uptick in young Punjabi kids signing up to play in peewee leagues all across Canada.
The Edmonton Oilers drafted Jujhar Khera, and he's a Punjabi boy, and the Everett Silvers tips out in Washington out west. They even had an all Punjabi line a couple of years back. So I think the seeds are being planted, and I think that's going to help grow our show, and it's also going to help grow the popularity of the game within the community once the community sees familiar faces on the ice in the NHL. So that's just the next step for sure.
Harner Ayan Singh is host and play-by-play commentator of Hockey Night in Canada, Punjabi. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Public education faces a lot of challenges, and one of them is creating a learning environment where low-income students can succeed. Now, California thinks it may have found a fix, giving schools with large numbers of at-risk students more state funding and more control over how to spend that money. Education reporter Anna Tentakulis from member station KQED in San Francisco wanted to find out whether the extra money is actually reaching one group of high-need students, English language learners, kids who speak English as a second language. So she camped out at one school, Oak Ridge Elementary in Sacramento, where the community is at odds over how much money is being spent.
Everybody say red.
Red.
Sound red.
Red. I'm sitting with a handful of first graders on a rainbow-colored rug as they focus on Catherine Craig, the reading specialist here. She points to letters on flashcards. Most of the kids speak Spanish at home. Here, they get 45 minutes of intense instruction 4 days a week on the basics of the English language.
It's very scientific, you know. It's almost like sort of a doctor who gives a test, and you see what the prescription is, and then there's a lot of repetition. You know, I've been teaching this program for 5 years, and I always see students make a ton of growth.
That's why she was shocked when she learned the program will be cut next year. Mrs. Craig will not come back, which still leaves her a little speechless.
I feel really lucky to have been here, that this is a really great school. I mean, I guess it's hard for me to say. I guess I just feel that, you know, I don't know.
Under California's new way of handing out money to schools, Oak Ridge is getting a burst of extra state funding for its English learners every year. But a big chunk of the funding is paying for the school's assistant principal, not for trained language specialists. It's an example of how local spending decisions for at-risk kids are creating a backlash.
It is a population that's really near and dear to my heart.
Stephanie Smith teaches fourth grade at Oak Ridge and worries school leaders here are simply funding existing people in programs without exploring other ways to really help English learners succeed. She says hiring specialists is key.
A book that's collecting dust on my shelf because it's a glossy, cool curriculum is not going to make a difference. But systematically figuring out where we're going to put our human resources is where I see the valuing of our English learners.
Spell it and?
And use each word in a sentence.
Okay, so say it out loud to help your brain.
I used to be 8 years old.
Smith works with 9-year-old Alicia Hernandez in her classroom. She says Alicia is part of a hidden population of English learners in public schools. They may speak English conversationally, but academically they're not proficient. They're also not proficient in their native language, so they're stuck. In the classroom next door, another one of those hidden English learners struggles with her writing.
My name is Kenya Vargas Cepeda. I'm in fourth grade.
Kenya was born in Mexico and went to preschool there. Like many English learners, she often feels lost in class.
When I was little, I used to have lots of imagination in my head, and I used to have all these ideas to write about. But I don't know what happened, but my thoughts aren't that good anymore, and I don't really know what to write down.
It's kind of scary for me.
That's April Ibarra, Kenya's mother.
She doesn't have that extra support that was once there. So who's going to help her? Who's going to be there for her when she's struggling? Until people understand fully what English language learners need, how their education can be affected if it's not given the support that it needs, then our children are in for trouble.
I sat down with Oak Ridge principal Daniel Roletti to understand why he eliminated their full-time language specialists to fund the assistant principal. He argues the assistant principal helps manage students' behavior problems, which is extremely important because students can focus on learning and educators can focus on teaching. And he adds their classroom teachers do have the training and skills to help English learners.
When you deal with the reality of the community that we serve, I feel we are providing the highest quality education that we can for our students and our families, and I feel they genuinely appreciate it and love us for that.
But all of these spending decisions are a gamble, and the community is on edge. The only way to find out if the more than 500 students here will benefit is to wait and see.
Anna Tintakala sent us that report. She's education reporter for member station KQED in San Francisco. Well, it's no surprise that online behavior is tracked. If you like Washington politics, you're going to get political stories in your newsfeed. Bought cat litter lately? Surprise, cat food ad. But imagine if your search history could help pre-diagnose cancer or depression and send you information on how to get help. Researchers at Microsoft revealed this week that by analyzing search queries, they were able to identify internet users who were suffering from pancreatic cancer even before those people were diagnosed. And the news brings both excitement and a lot of questions about what this means for the future of medicine and for ethics. Joining me now are Dr. Eric Horvitz. He's scientist and managing co-director at Microsoft Research and co-author of the study. Also, Dr. Kelly Harding. She's a psychiatrist from Columbia University Medical Center, and she researches health anxiety in the digital age. Welcome to you both.
Great. Nice to be here. Thanks.
Yes. Thank you so much for having us.
Eric Horvitz, let me start with you. First of all, the practical. What do people who have pancreatic cancer but don't know it search for online?
Well, I hate to raise anxieties out there by talking about common symptoms. But one of the challenges is that these symptoms often present as nonspecific. And I've had several friends and colleagues that have gone through this generalized itchiness and some strange gnawing back pain of various kinds, light-colored stools and so on. Each one of these symptoms taken separately typically wouldn't be a reason to run to a physician or be too concerned. But what we were looking for were complicated temporal patterns or fingerprints that might not even be known by clinical medicine yet that we can see over thousands of people and millions of people.
And the aggregation of these symptoms all together instead of separately that might lead to somebody who might be sick. Well, Kelly Harding, let me go to you because you're a psychiatrist, and now studies have already shown that online search can identify or at least signal depression better than a lot of diagnostic tools that are available. So what's your take on the promise of this?
Sure. Well, I think when the study first broke, there was a lot of questions about, is my computer keeping secrets from me? And who is it maybe sharing my deepest, darkest fears with? But I think the thing to keep in mind is there's actually a potential for tremendous public good. And, we're entering a new age where we're now looking at pre-screening, not just screening for diagnosis. And studies like this are really emphasizing that. There have been studies already done that show that there can be a lead time in terms of identifying flu outbreaks, sometimes up to 5 weeks in advance, which is tremendous. Symptoms of depression, there's evidence that people will tell their computer things before they'll tell another person because, a lot of times it's embarrassing and frankly, search engines aren't judgmental.
Now, Eric Horvitz, Kelly Harding has brought some of the ethical concerns already into view here. And I want to go there because part of the question is what you do with all this info. Right away, you can see the problems, not only looking at somebody's searches, but analyzing them and then potentially breaching their medical privacy by looking at their searches and knowing what they might have and then talking to them about it.
Yeah, I have to say that I'm as interested as you and others about the interesting challenges that come up with data privacy and thinking about the greater good. At a place like Microsoft Research and Microsoft Corporation, we abide by very strict guidelines in terms of aggregate data, anonymization, privacy. This kind of study goes through our ethics advisory process as well. But in the long term, there is this idea that online data might one day be used to jump the tracks between non-medical and medical. And this is an area of discussion, and we've written on this ourselves, a piece in Science magazine just last August you can read about.
Okay. The ethical considerations, of course, are replete throughout online search, right? This isn't just about medicine. We could talk about national security and analyzing search and maybe somebody, if somebody has a predilection to violence or jihadism. And, there are all kinds of implications here. But Eric Horvitz, not just analyzing the data, which is big data. I think we all understand what that means if it's anonymous. What about going back to the user and saying, hey, Bill, we've been looking at your searches. Have you thought about pancreatic cancer?
It's interesting. When we have this kind of a result, which was just a feasibility study, to ask the question, is this even possible? And the answer was yes, we found. The next step is, well, how would you actually field it? How would you use this? And this is a question we ask ourselves and we want to reflect about with our clinical colleagues and with consumers. You can imagine one day, for example, there's an opt-in service that people say, I'd like to actually have my search logs look in a very private manner for me in the service of my health. Here's what you can do with them. You could also imagine various ways of making sure that consumers get a sense for possibilities, not to frighten people, but to say, hey, you might want to mention these three symptoms to your doctor that you've been looking at lately.
Kelly Harding, talk about the ethics from your point of view. You treat depression all the time. You're a psychiatrist. Now, you mentioned identifying flu epidemics. That's an epidemiologic problem. You can identify an area of the country where people are searching symptoms and say, whoa, epidemic. That's not an individual. We're talking about individuals with illnesses that may be extremely private.
So it's true. And I think when you're sitting in front of a computer, it feels like a very private experience. And it's shocking for some people that it might be more public than that. It does seem as though it's going to take a lot of thinking about how to go forward working with the technology companies, how to get the person from the computer to the clinic and do that in a way that they don't feel overly petrified by getting a message, hey, you may have pancreatic cancer. That would, you know, probably hold someone in their tracks.
But as somebody who sort of lives and works at the intersection between mental health and digital use, this strikes you as great promise or ethically fraught or really both, and we're going to find our way through it.
Well, I think, you know, the reality is that the technology is here and we have to figure out a way to move forward using it for the greater good. And I think as long as we have people that are doing it consciously and in a way that's careful about patients' privacies and respecting rights in that sense, that I think there's a way forward. But it is going to take a lot of people between public health, technology, physicians thinking about how to, and also patients, how to put this all together.
And Eric Horowitz at Microsoft, do you think that the field is prepared for that deep and nuanced ethical discussion?
Oh, I think it's quite prepared, and it's one that is engaging to many interested folks, including our teams. I should say that there are some prospects that technology can give us win-wins here. For example, training up these detectors or sensors that work on with anonymized data, and then fielding local apps in people's phones that work only in their own, in the privacy of their own devices, that and where no personal data is shared at all, yet people have the access to the intelligence which was trained off the large-scale data.
We are reaching a point where your online searches can tell someone somewhere else about what diseases you could have or what your aggregate symptoms might mean. Great promise and also ethical issues for the future of medicine. Kelly Harding, psychiatrist at Columbia. Dr. Eric Horowitz, distinguished scientist and managing director at Microsoft Research. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Your health.
For your health. For your health.
This is Victoria in Austin, Texas. 9 times out of 10, I do try to find health information online, and most of the time that tells me what I need to know. If I try the recommendations and then it doesn't work, then I go to the experts in person.
And we got this from Chicago. I've learned the hard way. Do not self-diagnose online. You'll need a psychiatrist instead of a doctor. Every sniffle turns into cancer. Eek, research is wonderful, but confirmation should be done by the professionals. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.